Chartists. So a little bit of conclusion on the Chartists, and then the following years. No, I think I've given you most of my conclusions as I went along. Yeah, the complexity of the movement, the originality of the movement, the tactical debates, strategic debates, debates about what kind of society do we want, is it possible to avoid this society, how can we get our demands? Just another couple of things I wanted to mention. One is that whole sections of the Chartists were very much involved in international politics. They ran a campaign of solidarity with the Hungarian struggle for independence. When the Austrian general came to Britain, he was attacked. And when Louis Philippe came, there were demonstrations against Louis Philippe. When the Tsar of Russia came, there were demonstrations against the Tsar of Russia. So there was the beginnings of, in a way, it is the beginnings of the aspects of a political party. That is, a political party, we consider it normal for a political party to have an opinion about everything, or almost everything. Foreign policy, home policy, tactics, strategy, etc. Whereas previous campaigns, like the campaign for the abolition of the slave trade, were not interested in having a general view of politics. Chartism is like the embryo of a political party. They are interested in a lot of questions, although at the centre they put the right to vote. Okay, so what happens next? Well, that's the end of Chartism, and it won't come back. There will be, and I will be describing them in a moment, much more protests and campaigns so that more people can have the vote. But the protests and campaigns, which we will see later, will not have the sort of revolutionary atmosphere of Chartism. They will be more moderate. Chartism was really, we want the vote to transform society. We want the vote to make the rich and the poor equal. Very, very radical. Even if the tactics could be very confused, it was very much a sort of revolutionary atmosphere. The later campaigns will be much more precise about getting the vote, and will not have that Chartist thing. So, the follow-ups. Well, probably the most radical follow-ups were elsewhere. In Australia in 1854, I'm not going to talk about it in detail because it's a long way away, but in 1854, so 6 years after the last big Chartist petition, there was a gold miners' revolt in Ballarat. There's a very nice museum there. I went last year. And this gold miners' revolt, they decide to have to adopt the demands of the English Chartists. Yeah, so there's a revolt about who controls the society around the gold mines. The golds are a lot of gold is discovered very, very quickly. If you ever go to Melbourne, Melbourne in Australia looks like Leeds with a lot more money. And it was built in 20 years. Yeah, they suddenly found gold, and it was a huge impressive city. And so the miners organized a revolt around the Eureka. The Eureka Stockade is the place of an armed battle between the authorities and the gold miners. It's become symbolically in Australia, it is considered to be the beginning of Australian democracy. Eureka is the national symbol, in the way that La Révolution Française, Prise la Bastille, is taken as the symbol of the beginning of the Republic. The Eureka Stockade is that symbol. And interestingly enough, so 6 years after the last petition, they decided to take up exactly the demands of the Chartists. The right for all men to vote, abolition of the property qualifications for members of Parliament, payment of members of Parliament, secret ballot, short-term Parliament, etc. Although, and this gives you a clue to the future of the history of Australia, they define the first point as all men except Aboriginals should have the right to vote, yeah, and that is the whole, there you have the whole story of Australia, really, which was again in the news last week. I'm not going to give you the story in detail of Eureka for the simple reason that it is in Australia, and that's a long way away. I want to move on to the episodes leading up to the Second Reform Act, 1867. The Second Reform Act. The second one being, of course, the one after the first one. After the decline of the Chartist movement, for a long period, there was no mass movement looking for universal suffrage. The radical movement had collapsed. A lot of its leaders had gone to America. Workers' newspapers collapsed. Interestingly enough, Karl Marx, who is living at in London at this time, who is involved in politics before this collapse, he decides that there's no good reason to be involved in practical politics, and he spends 10 years in the British Library writing Das Kapital. Because he says, nothing's happening, there's no movement, I can spend 10 years in the British Library writing Das Kapital. So no real movement for universal suffrage. This does not mean, of course, that nothing happened. There was a certain tendency for radicals to concentrate on the trade unions. And this we will see again later in the century. There is often a coming and froing between work through parliaments, work through the trade unions. 5 years here, 5 years there. It's not a timetable. It's that if you are ordinary working people, very often people think there are two ways of having a better life. One, you organise a trade union. Of course, there are individual ways as well. You become the boss, yeah. But collective ways. One, you organise a trade union and you try to put pressure on the boss. We need better wages, and trade unions sometimes strike, etc. And so you put pressure on your boss. Other way, you put pressure on parliaments, much later in the 20th century, to establish a minimum wage, for example, or to reduce the number of hours in a working day, to pass a new law. So you have union activity, parliamentary activity, and there is a tendency for them to move one way and then the other. In the union activity, until sometimes when there is an economic crisis, it's too hard, and so, oh, let's work on getting more votes in the parliament instead. And then it doesn't work, and then there's a certain to-ing and fro-ing. And this is what's happening here for the first time, that there is a certain concentration on trade unions. For example, there is the movement for the 10-hour day. There is a movement, a campaign, saying 10 hours a day is enough to work. Yeah, that's the one of the campaigns in the 1850s. And secondly, there is the rise of the cooperative movement, the Mouvement des Coopératifs. And this is a way of establishing companies where workers work for workers, yeah? In cooperative ouvrière, where establishing companies where the workers work are the boss as well. Yeah, that kind of thing, cooperative de production. So it's in the mid-1960s that the radical movement begins to revive. Karl Marx will write the inaugural address to the International Working Men's Association, the establishment of a new organization, the International Working Men's Association. And this association will influence a new generation of radicals. In Parliament, however, not much is happening. There have been three or four bills to suggest they increase a little bit the number of voters, but nobody is really very excited about them. And interestingly enough, every time the bills are not successful, the elite is still very frightened of having more voters. They're also very frightened in 1859 when there is a big builders' strike. There's a big builders' strike. And if you listen or if you read some of the debates inside the parliaments at this time, you can see the kind of attitudes they had. One member of parliament says, reducing the franchise to allow manual labour must end by giving manual labour the political power over the capital that employs it and the mind that should direct it. Yeah. si nous réduisons les conditions de vote pour permettre aux ouvriers manuels, au travail manuel de voter, à la fin, ça veut dire que nous allons donner au travail manuel le pouvoir politique au-dessus du capital qui l'emploie et au-dessus de l'esprit qui devrait le diriger. So it's a very traditional sort of way of looking at the world. Some members of parliament had been to Australia, and in Australia more people could vote, and they came back from Australia rather shocked, and one of the members of parliament said, in Australia magistrates were being appointed from the lowest classes. Là-bas, des gens des classes les plus basses deviennent magistrats. Horrible shock. And another example, they said, in Australia, the new popular voters had forced public spending on railways. Yeah. Le nouvel électorat avait obligé le gouvernement à dépenser de l'argent pour la construction de chemins de fer. La nationalisation, c'est une chose très choquante. So, really, nobody in Parliament was demanding universal suffrage, and there was no mass movement outside Parliament, so it looked like nothing was going to happen. But, history being surprising like that, something did happen. 1864, the Liberals established the Reform Union, which is asking for very limited reform, and the following year, trade unions established the Reform League with the help of Karl Marx, asking for a much more radical reform, asking for universal suffrage. In 1865, the Liberals propose a bill for a very limited reform. The Reform League have a big debate about the 1865. The Reform League have a big debate about it. Inside the Reform League, mostly trade unionists, some people say, oh well, the proposal of the Liberals is a small reform, but a small reform is a beginning. Yeah, we need to support this bill. And other people say, the reform of the Liberals is so small, we don't want to report it, we want universal suffrage. So a standard debate, what do you do if you have a campaign for a big reform and somebody proposes a small reform? And the first section win, Karl Marx is horrified, because the Reform League decided to support the bill. Lord Derby wrote about the atmosphere in the country, about this reform bill. The bill is being discussed everywhere. There is great excitement in the upper classes. This is not shared by the people. And that's Lord Derby writing it. The debate continues for 8 days in Parliament. It's still a very controversial issue, even though it's a very small reform, a long debate in Parliament, 8 days of debates. And many ideas are floating around. The famous philosopher, John Stuart Mill, says he has a new idea. The voting system should not be based on property, but on education. People who can't read should get no vote. This is the opinion of John Stuart Mill, the philosopher. People who are very well educated should get two votes. This is his idea. It doesn't have this doesn't happen, of course, but it just shows you what kind of debate there is around. Another member of parliament says, "Oh no, we should give the vote to the workers, because if the workers have the vote, then they will let off steam, they will express themselves in the political process, and in this way, they will not be, and I quote, they will not be so obsessed with trade unions." So another, lots of different opinions going around. Some people say, give them the vote, that will calm them down. Other people say, no, it will be terribly dangerous. We will have magistrates from the lowest classes, etc. Big debate. And the leader of the opposition to the bill is a certain Mr. Horseman, who is absolutely convinced that the votes would be terrible. And he said, there is an irreconcilable enmity between democracy and freedom. Yeah. La démocratie, c'est le contraire même de la liberté. Democracy is a terrible thing. If we bring in democracy, we will not be free. Yeah. And the second thing he said, the first law of political life is that we in Parliament should rule by the voice of the educated minority. And so we can see the atmosphere. And finally, Disraeli, the great leader Disraeli, said, If we have a lot more people voting, the House of Commons will have no charm of tradition, no families of historic lineage, no statesmanship, no eloquence, no learning, no genius. Instead, you will have a horde of selfish and obscure mediocrities. Okay, so that's the atmosphere in the Parliament. The Reform Bill is voted through in the House of Commons, but then collapses before it arrives to the House of Lords, is not successful. And then, at the moment when everybody thinks it's the end of the story, the movement comes back. And you have a big demonstration in May 1866, and on the 2nd of July, a mass rally in Trafalgar Square. And the movement calls for a demonstration in Hyde Park on the 22nd of July. The demonstration is declared illegal. The government says this demonstration is illegal. And the leadership of the Reform League are split. Every crisis, the leadership splits. One half says, oh, well, if it's illegal, let's have the demonstration somewhere else. Another half says, no, we don't care if they say it's illegal. We are going to Hyde Park. And the compromise is, okay, well, we'll go towards Hyde Park, but if the police stop us, we'll go somewhere else. That's the compromise. But on the day, the leadership of the demonstration said, okay, we're going to Trafalgar Square, because the police are stopping us. But a significant minority said, no, we're going to Hyde Park. And the fighting with the police continued for 3 days. 3 days of fighting with the police. And the movement continued to rise. 300,000 people demonstrated in Birmingham in October. 250,000 in Manchester in November. Some links established with the Irish independence movement. The parliamentary debate continued for many months. The movement was getting bigger, although, as I mentioned before, none of the revolutionary talk, no arms, etc., none of the revolutionary talk from the days of the Chartists. Another demonstration in Hyde Park was called. It was declared illegal by the government. Posters by the government everywhere, thousands of troop and police prepared, but on the day of the demonstration was so big that the government decided that the troops should go home. And for the first time, a social movement openly and successfully defied the law. Yeah, the government said, this demonstration is illegal. And they had the demonstration anyway, and the government said, shall we send the soldiers or not? If we send the soldiers, the movement could be 10 times bigger next week. Let's not send the soldiers. And that's very, very for the first time, the Home Secretary resigned, and very, very rapidly, the bill, which had been quite moderate, became very radical. The government suddenly decided, oh yes, let's have more people voting. The members of Parliament were very, very surprised, and the 1867 Reform Act was passed, much more radical than the Reform Bill 2 years previously when there was no movement. The 1867 Reform Act gave the vote to every man householder in the boroughs. Basically, 1.5 million new voters. Yeah, 1.5 million new voters. And that's where we're going to stop for today. Tomorrow I will have to give you the story about the 1884, the third Reform Act, and that's the last one. And also we have somebody who's going to give us a wonderful exposé tomorrow. Thank you for your attention.